Now, the big corporations that are investing, they want access to the Chinese market. These are a little different, right? Because they're not investing in Chinese companies. They want access to the 1.3 billion people, including, as you said, the over 400 million people in the middle income bracket. They can be customers for these big companies. Part of the economic war that the US is waging on China, they're telling investors, and all the media outlets are telling investors, China is risky. Do not invest in Chinese companies. And that's why we've seen this significant fall in the market cap of many companies in the Shanghai Exchange and the Hong Kong Exchange. And again, that's not the Chinese economy. Unlike the US, where everything is built around Wall Street, it's a financialized economy based on Wall Street. The idea in the US is what's good for Wall Street is what's good for the country, but it's not true. In China, these things are separate. The stock market is not...
Welcome to The Bridge. Fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Today with us is Ben Norton for the second time. He's a journalist and editor of geopoliticaleconomy.com. You can also find him on YouTube, Geopolitical Economy. His journalistic work has been published in dozens of media outlets, and he has done interviews with the BBC, Sky News, Al Jazeera, Democracy Now!, RT, CGTN, Press TV, Hispan TV, and various other TV and new media. Welcome back to The Bridge, Ben Norton.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, first things first, you know, you are living in Beijing, where I'm living too, but you've been here for a while now. Could you tell us a little bit about your impressions of China and how are you taking to life here?
It's great. The standard of living is very high. It's incredible to see the level of development. The level of infrastructure is absolutely amazing. And, you know, Jason, you and I are both originally from the United States, and the infrastructure in China, which is still a developing country, is much better than the infrastructure in the US, which is supposedly, you know, the richest country. Although actually, in reality, China overtook the US as the largest economy on earth in 2016. But the point is that China actually prioritizes investment in public goods, infrastructure, public transportation. The level of security is absolutely amazing. You never have to worry about being robbed. You know, women can walk around at night without any issues. I mentioned public transportation, which is amazing. I mean, the subway is amazing, the trains. So yeah, it's been great. I also just, I love the food. So it's been a great experience. And I have to say that when I first got here, it's been about 6 months now, I was really kind of struck by how different things were and in many ways different in a good way. And very quickly, I kind of got used to it, right? You know, you can get used to the kind of comforts that I was talking about. And I can't even imagine now living in a place like the US. You realize that people say they have higher paychecks, but in reality, they have to pay so much more for all of these goods. They don't have access to many of these social services and institutions. And I think that's why it's not a surprise that people in China who go visit the West, they often come back and they're actually more grateful because they can see these kinds of things. And I wish in the US we could actually adopt some of these policies as well.
You know, for me personally, my reverse culture shock going back to the United States for the first time after having lived in China for 5 years was getting on Amtrak. And after having ridden Chinese high-speed rail trains, I mean, I like Amtrak. I'm not complaining. It gets me around in California. But it was like literally banging and clanking, like compared to like where you can set a coin in the window in a Chinese train, high-speed train, and it just stays up. So I was just like, wow, there is a dramatic difference here. But I guess that part of that is that the US developed its infrastructure first. And so China came later and had the opportunity to build more, you know, technologically advanced infrastructure. But you bring up an interesting point that I think a lot of people don't understand. And I think it is something a lot of people want to understand. You mentioned that China's economy has passed that of the United States around 2016. A lot of people are not of that impression, that China's economy is still the second largest economy in the world. And you hear that a lot in media. And so a lot of people get confused when some people are asserting that China has the largest economy and some people are asserting that the U.S. has the largest economy. Why is there this disconnect? And the reason we hear it articulated differently at different times by different people?
Great question. And I will respond to it in 1 second, but just you mentioned the issue of the difference between public transportation in China and the U.S. And you said maybe it's because the U.S. developed earlier, but I actually don't really think that's the main reason. The main reason is that in the U.S., there is almost no public transportation, and the extent to which there is transportation infrastructure, it was created to make a profit by many private corporations. And in the case of the U.S., we also saw, going back to Henry Ford, that the private car companies lobbied very aggressively to prevent the government from significantly investing in public transportation. And there's been a systematic underfunding and defunding of the public transportation that does exist, like in New York City, for instance, which is falling apart, the subway. So in China, it's the exact opposite. The government oversees the infrastructure construction and has invested huge sums because they understand that this is a public good. And if they want to improve the quality of living and develop their economy and also make their manufacturing sector more competitive and more efficient, then they need to, the government, the state needs to invest in creating these forms of public transportation, which economists refer to as public goods. Whereas, you know, in the neoliberal model in the West, there are no public goods, everything's privatized. But anyway, getting back to your point about the how the economy is measured, I think this is very important because you're right. If you read most Western media outlets, they constantly say that the US still has the largest economy and China is the second largest. This is very misleading because this is a way of measuring the size of the economy, the gross domestic product, GDP, in what they call nominal terms. And what that means is that they take every economy around the world, all of the goods and services produced in an economy, and then they take the exchange rate in that country, whatever the currency is locally, and then they simply multiply it by the exchange rate to the dollar. So in China, everything revolves around the renminbi, right? The yuan. So the exchange rate is roughly around 7.3, 7.5. So what they do is they take all of the goods and services produced in China and simply exchange it to dollars as if China was using dollars, but they don't actually adjust for the cost of things relative to the use of yuan. So what do I mean by that? So obviously, if you go to a store, you're not using dollars. So simply multiplying it to get dollars doesn't make sense because in the US, something that you buy in dollars might actually end up being much more expensive than something you buy in China. So for instance, if you go to a store, go to a restaurant, and you get a plate of food, you know, noodles or, you know, a dinner or whatever, oftentimes in China, it's maybe, you know, 20, 25, 30, maybe 40 yuan. So it's around 4, 5, 6 US dollars. You get the same thing in the US and it's $20 easily, especially with inflation going up. So you can't simply just multiply it and get dollars without accounting for the purchasing power of people in China, what they can buy with those yuan. So not just converting them to dollars. And when you do that, you get the best form of measurement, which is known as purchasing power parity. And it's frankly outrageous that still mainstream economists don't use purchasing power parity. To be honest, many do. This has been a change in the past few decades. We've seen, for instance, the IMF has moved toward using purchasing power parity because it's simply ridiculous to use the nominal terms, especially in a moment right now when the US dollar is very overvalued because the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has significantly raised interest rates, which has increased the dollar, the value of the dollar against other currencies that have fallen against the dollar, including the euro and also the yuan. So the point is that it doesn't make sense to measure everything in dollars, which is often what economists do because the dollar is the global reserve currency, right? And because of US economic hegemony. In reality, if you look at what you can purchase with local currency in China, the purchasing power, China overtook the size of the US economy in 2016 and continues to grow. And this is also important because some people say, well, actually, PPP measurement is not very useful because commodities and international markets are largely priced in dollars. Now, there's an element of truth in this, especially for poor developing economies, because they're often very reliant on importing foreign technologies, capital goods, and primary products like oil, gas, food stuffs. But in the case of China, over 80% of the domestic production is local, and especially in terms of manufacturing. China is the world's manufacturing superpower, but also China increasingly produces the majority of its food to become food sovereign. China has the entire global supply chain located in the country. So there only are a few products that China relies on importing, especially things like energy. And increasingly, China is not using dollars to import those commodities. So President Xi visited Saudi Arabia and met with the GCC and also met with the Arab League and announced that China is working on agreements to buy oil and gas from the Persian Gulf region in yuan, in its own currency. There have been reports as well that the United Arab Emirates has been selling gas to China using yuan. And now the Chinese Central Bank, the People's Bank of China, has worked on a new system using central bank digital currencies in order to settle payment imbalances between the Central Bank of the UAE and the Central Bank of China using their local currencies, using the yuan. So increasingly, it makes no sense whatsoever to measure the Chinese economy mm-hmm. with dollars.
Well, we talked about your experience of living here in Beijing and your own experience in the last 6 months or so. I think it may even be longer than 6 months. But you were also a journalist covering economics. And I was wondering, because online, you know, we see a lot of people who have, especially in the West, very distorted views of what life is like in China, not for us, but for average Chinese people. And, you know, as a journalist covering economics in China, what do you notice about the standard of living here for regular Chinese folks in Beijing and other cities that you visited?
Yeah, well, we have to understand that China is still developing, right? So it's not always very fair to simply compare China to the US because they're in very different stages of development. The US, of course, developed over hundreds of years through first colonialism and ethnic cleansing of the indigenous peoples, through slavery, chattel slavery of Africans. And then, of course, the US has waged many wars around the world, engaged in imperialist policies and exploitation. China's rise has been peaceful. China does not invade foreign countries. It does not overthrow their elected governments to try to take their natural resources. China does not super exploit, you know, the labor of people in the global south. I mean, China is focused on developing its own economy, and it has done so at an incredible pace in the recent decades and lifted more than 800 million people out of poverty. It's absolutely remarkable. But again, China's still in the process of developing. And so the thing about China is that obviously there are still people who are humble and struggling and, you know, trying to make ends meet, and they do have support, right? The government has provided so much support for poverty alleviation, especially in rural areas, in terms of housing, in terms of doctors, sending out doctors to the countryside, education. So it's making a lot of progress, especially in the rural areas. And in the cities, you can see that because the government has invested so much in public services, public goods, including infrastructure, transportation, health, what this means is that people, even if they still have relatively low wages compared to the West, they still have a high standard of living. And because, as I mentioned, so many products are produced locally, in the majority of the food is produced locally, they can keep those prices low. So food prices in China are very low compared to the US. In fact, one of the biggest complaints you hear, you know, I'm sure you've heard this from friends and family in the US, is that food inflation has been horrific in the past few years. Mm-hmm. Constantly the price of eggs and bread and vegetables, those prices have skyrocketed. And part of that was because of the pandemic and the supply chain disruptions. Another big reason is because of what's known as greedflation. These corporations that are basically monopolies mm-hmm. and are taking advantage of their market power to push up prices. There's been a lot of good work on this done by the economist Isabella Weber. So the point is that China doesn't have those problems. China is able to provide these services in a way, thanks to the government's policy, thanks to socialism with Chinese characteristics. And also there are many forms of support for people in the community as well. And this is something that, you know, in the US society has become very atomized because it's so individualist, right? Whereas in China, it's still common to have many of these social support mechanisms. So that's why if you look at average wages and disposable income in China, and then you simply convert them to dollars, people are sometimes surprised. They're like, wow, Many people only make, you know, $1,000, $2,000 a month, many working people. But again, that's misleading because you're thinking of how expensive it is to live in the US and saying, I couldn't live in $1,000 or $2,000 a month in the US. But in China, because the cost of living is so low and there are these public services, and because, again, the exchange rate is misleading because the yuan is actually much stronger than it looks like compared to the dollar and the exchange rate. In reality, people do actually live much more comfortably than it seems like in these hysterical Western media propaganda that says that people are struggling so much.
You know, I've actually been taking some pictures of some street food vendors where things are on sale that are remarkably, you know, it could make comprise a meal that costs like 2 kuai, which is a quarter or something. So, I'm going to post some of those in the future. But, you know, one thing that really gets me kind of upset, maybe I don't understand the problem fully, is that in the US especially, but in other countries that are allies of the US, they are constantly saying China's economy is in the gutter. China's economy is slowing down. But China's GDP last year for all four quarters was an average of 5.2% growth, whereas the United States came in at 2.5%. growth. And everyone's like, wow, the United States is doing amazing. And Yellen famously said that the US economy had beaten all expectations and done better than all G7 partners, which it had. But if China's economy is growing at 5.2% and the US economy is growing at 2.5%, less than half of that, how is it that some Western journalists are able to say that China's economy is doing bad and that the US economy is doing good? I really don't understand.
Yeah, well, a lot of this is psychological projection, accusing your so-called adversary of what you yourself are suffering of guilty of. And in the case of the Western economies, we see stagnation and really the return of what's known as stagflation, which was a problem in the 70s, in which you simultaneously have economic stagnation and high rates of inflation. Now, it's true that the US GDP growth looks like it's very high, especially compared to the economies of Europe, many of which have entered recession. Like in Germany, it's officially entered recession, the UK as well. Now, the US growth rate does look to be pretty high, but there are a few major caveats here. First of all, last year in 2023, according to Federal Reserve data, the US deficit, the federal government deficit as a percentage of GDP was 6.2%, which is massive. This is almost like a wartime deficit. And it's actually similar to the deficit in 2009, 2010, when the US was engaged in a massive stimulus because of the 2008 financial crisis. So this is, people refer to this as kind of fiscal dominance. If the government is spending a lot of money into the economy and it has all of this debt, that can be a stimulus and it can help grow the economy. This is going back to John Maynard Keynes, and this is how economies dealt with depressions ever since. The rise of Keynesian economics, this kind of counter-cyclical approach where if your economy is declining, you have a recession, then you should engage in a stimulus, right? Now, right now, we're speaking on the 7th of March, and the two sessions are going on here in Beijing in China, right? Mm-hmm. And there's discussion of the work report that was released by the premier, and the discussion is potentially up to a deficit of 3% of GDP in China, up to. But that's actually probably, that's the upper limit. It's probably going to be around maybe 2% of deficit of GDP. Now, people are referring to that as a stimulus in China, a 2% GDP deficit. Now, in the US, it's over 6%. But people don't call that a stimulus. It's a massive stimulus. So yeah, if the government spends a lot into the economy, you can grow the economy. Okay. But we need to keep that in mind with the US. Furthermore, we also need to look at the quality of growth. In the US, much of this growth is in the service sector. And oftentimes, it's in jobs that are not very high quality jobs, that are kind of precarious jobs. So it's not like they have good unionized manufacturing jobs. Most of those jobs have been destroyed. And to the extent that those jobs do exist anymore, the US also is engaging, once again, in massive subsidies in industrial policy. And I'm not in any way against industrial policy. China has shown the power of industrial policy. What people don't know, what is industrial policy? It is basically a kind of limited form of government planning, targeting particular sectors, industries that the government wants to expand, wants to become competitive in through providing infrastructure development, subsidies, tax breaks, the kinds of things that China has done to develop, to be the world leader in electric vehicles, what they call the three new industries, mm-hmm. electric vehicles, solar panels, and lithium batteries. China's become the world leaders in those industries. And the US now, because it's unable to compete with China, it is also using forms of industrial policy, abandoning this pretense of this neoliberal capitalist dogma that we've been told, you know, the free market will be able to win. Well, the free market's not able to beat China. So that's why the US is resorting to protectionist policies, tariffs on Chinese goods, and industrial policy. And the Biden administration passed what's known as the Inflation Reduction Act, which, according to Goldman Sachs economists, will likely result in trillions, with the T, trillions of dollars of stimulus, of subsidies and tax breaks and other benefits for companies in manufacturing in the US, including, by the way, many manufacturers from Europe, from places like Germany, which are being deindustrialized largely due to the policies of the US and the war in Ukraine and the sanctions on Russia and the economic war on China. So many of these companies are now moving over to the US because the US government is saying, we'll give you subsidies, tax breaks, and other benefits. So again, we need to look at the US economic growth in that context and then look at China's growth. And China is going through an economic transition. There's this ridiculous nonstop propaganda in the West claiming that China's economy is going to collapse. It's the Japanification of China. It's going to go into stagnation. This is all ridiculous because it misunderstands that the Chinese model is fundamentally different. The Chinese model is not simply based on expanding services, in particular financial services and financial speculation, whereas in the US, you have this massive bubble, which is driving a lot of economic growth. And in the, you look in the US stock market, for instance, people say, oh my God, look in the S&P 500, it's skyrocketing. But in reality, much of that growth, the majority of it, is in seven companies, which are known as the Magnificent Seven, these big tech monopolies in the US. And in China, it's the opposite. We see that instead of this concentrated growth in one particular sector and financial speculation, we see that actually in China, there's been all this reporting about the stock market's in crisis because the Western media tells investors to dump all their stocks that they hold from Chinese companies. So then they're selling their stocks. So then the stock prices fall. But the economy is growing because the economy is not the stock market. In China, we see that very clearly. The stock market is not the same thing as the economy. Most people don't care about the stock market. Whereas in the US, everything is built around the stock market because everything is based around these capitalist oligarchs, these wealthy investors. And if they make more money, if they have more wealth, then the idea is that everyone is better off. It's not true. Actually, it's becoming more unequal. We're seeing more poverty and homelessness in the US. Whereas in China, the emphasis is now on high quality growth. Not simply growth for growth's sake, because if you simply say we want to have 10% growth, then what you're going to have is continued bubbles of debt, like we saw companies like Evergrande engaged in to try to pump up the real estate market. And that's why President Xi said famously, houses are for living in, not for speculation. And the government passed a series of policies starting in 2020 with the Three Red Lines policy, in which China said, we are going to prevent real estate companies from being over-leveraged, which means having too much debt, engaging in these very risky financial behaviors that can facilitate the potential crisis that we saw in the US in 2008. So the government intentionally popped the real estate bubble to deleverage the sector, to reduce the overall debt, to deflate the bubble, to try to make housing more affordable for working people in the country, and to focus on high quality economic growth, in particular in technology sectors. I mentioned renewable energy and other high value added sectors. So China can be a world leader in the green transition, the move toward artificial intelligence and other technologies that will determine the future. Oh,
yeah. You're listening to The Bridge.
I guess my next question is about what Xi Jinping referred to 3 or 4 years ago originally as a dual circulation economy, where China is trying to have a consumer-based economy in addition to, you know, an export-based economy. So over Chinese New Year Spring Festival, some records were set. Not everything was a record, but some of it reverted back to 2019 before the pandemic to those levels. And some in some categories of consumption, it exceeded previous historical spending over the same period. Do you think China is on its way to having a, you know, meaningful consumer economy that is going to add value to China?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this. This has been a policy for several years, and steadily we've seen the growth in consumption. But it depends on how you measure consumption, because there are some economists who are very critical of the Chinese government's policy in terms of investment in infrastructure and industry. And they claim that there needs to be much, much, much more consumption. But a lot of this goes back to the issue of how these things are measured. So first of all, we should keep in mind a few important details. Now, if you look at consumer spending in China, it has been increasing. But some economists will say that the consumption share of GDP is not increasing enough. But what they often don't mention is that, the consumption share of GDP is low in China for a few reasons. One, because the cost of living has been reduced, which means that healthcare spending and education spending is much lower than, for instance, in the United States, where consumption rates are very, very, very high, especially as a percentage of GDP. But a big reason for that is simply because healthcare is obscenely expensive. And also education, private education, is obscenely expensive. People spending $50,000 a year to send their kids to high school, private high schools, right? Which is way more than most people in China make an entire year in their salary. So the reality is that that's very skewed. Furthermore, house ownership is very important. Now, a little over 90% of people in China own their houses, which is amazing. In the US, it's around 60-something, and that figure has been decreasing over time, not increasing, as real estate has become unaffordable. Now, furthermore, in China, the vast majority of people who have a house do not use mortgages from the bank. Only a small percentage of people in China do that, which means that when people in China buy a house, they sell a house and buy a new one, or they also engage in renovation, which is very common. You know, I live in an apartment complex, and one of my neighbors, actually, it's kind of annoying, has been doing renovation for several weeks, and the drills and stuff all the time, right? It's very common in China because a lot of the housing was built maybe in the, at least in Beijing. If you're in another city, right, one of the newer cities, Shenzhen, Chongqing, a lot of this, the housing is new, right? But in a place like Beijing, the housing might be several decades old, so people are engaged in renovation. So if you look at how accounting is done, a lot of these debates are about accounting. When you look at GDP, which is a mixture, how it's measured, it's government expenditure, it's consumption, it's investment, and it's exports minus imports. Now, if you look at the investment share of GDP, what that includes people who renovate their apartment or buy a house. And of course, that's obviously the most expenses that you're going to have as a household. It's the most expensive thing in China that you're going to be engaged in is either buying a house or renovating. But that is included in the investment share of GDP in the measurement. So that's why, again, I'm not saying that consumption in China is not lower. It is lower. If you look at household consumption, it is lower than in the US, which is a very consumption-oriented economy, largely, once again, because it's been deindustrialized. There is so little manufacturing, and also because the dollar is the global reserve currency. So the US can maintain massive current account deficits, which means that for many decades, starting in the 1970s, the US has been importing way more than it exports. And if you just look at a graph of the US current account deficit, it's just mind-blowing. And for most countries, they would not be able to do that, to import way more than they export, because it would lead to a depreciation of their currency. You would have an inflation crisis like we see in countries like Argentina, right? In the US, the reason they can do that is because the dollar is the global reserve currency. Inflation is exported internationally. There's always this global demand for dollars. So the US can maintain this kind of consumption-oriented economy at a way that no other economy can. So yes, the Chinese government is going through this transition. Again, it's what I was talking about. It's a moment of economic transition. And part of it is this idea of dual circulation to increase domestic consumption. And I think it's also very important because, as we see, the US trade war on China and the growing economic tensions. Now, you know, Donald Trump is threatening 60% tariffs at least on all Chinese products, which would be crazy, and also massively increase inflation in the US. What we see is that this means that China is understanding that its export-oriented model could potentially be a weakness because it has to have access to foreign markets to sell those exports. So it's also a way of maintaining economic security for China if it's not as dependent on exporting to the U.S. market or other markets and has more domestic consumption and local demand. It can have more of a self-sustained, self-sufficient economy. So this is a perfectly rational policy. And again, it's going to happen over years. It's not going to happen immediately, but we're seeing a moment of economic transition in China. And that's why these Western media reports are so misleading. China is not collapsing. Its economy is not going into stagnation, all of this. It's simply changing its economic model.
You know, I also noticed, I saw a graph yesterday. It was a moving graph over time. And it showed that China is exporting more to the developing world than to the EU or the United States or the United States and the EU combined. So even if the United States were to go into full tariff mode, like, China would still have, you know, some places to export its products. I have a different question, though, and it's something I do want to understand, really. So China, and I've been talking about this online, too. What is China's role in consumption and tourism? You know, the U.S. has, in its middle class, I've looked up the data, about 133 million people that are defined as U.S. middle class citizens. And in China, it's something like 400 or 500 million. Discretionary income is different. It almost looks like about double in the United States. Discretionary income, I mean, the United States is wealthier per capita. But, you know, what does it mean for businesses, international companies especially, that China has about triple the amount of people in its middle class as the United States? Does that affect their decision in terms of where they're going to open new franchises, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually a big part of the push for more domestic consumption in China, is encouraging internal tourism, which is a great idea, because especially in some areas in China that were not as developed as the urban areas in the coast, This has become a priority of the government. And in fact, if we go to the 19th National Congress of the Communist Party, that was in 2017, the CPC announced that they changed what they refer to as the primary contradiction in Chinese society, which previously had been the underdevelopment. And they said that the goal was to develop the productive forces. This goes back to Deng Xiaoping, who said at the beginning of the reform and opening up period in 1978, that China had to expand its industrial manufacturing capabilities, move up the value chain, and improve the productive capacity of the economy. And China has done that incredibly. It's become the world's leader in manufacturing. Now China represents 35% of gross output and nearly 30% of value-added production of manufacturing. So it's an incredible achievement. And now that they've achieved this level and they can produce basically everything, including the most cutting edge technologies, now the government has said that we're going to prioritize common prosperity and better balancing the level of development inside the country. So they said that one of the issues that we now face is that the coastal areas, the big cities in the southeast and especially, you know, the special economic zones in these areas that have become, you know, Shenzhen, that have become these major technological hubs, they have developed much more than rural areas and especially in the kind of periphery of China, right? So the one way of encouraging that kind of development is having more tourism. They're also, by the way, moving a lot of factories, especially for kind of low value added products. They're moving factories and manufacturing to some of these provinces that have not developed as much. But also, again, encouraging tourism to these areas is another way, because you get people who have higher salaries in the urban areas and they go to the kind of more rural areas that are less developed and spend their money. And if you look at a lot of data, Chinese tourists actually tend to spend a lot when they travel abroad, but also internally. So I think this is a good idea. And also, we need to keep in mind, China is like a continent. I mean, 1.3 billion people. It's amazing. What they could accomplish, just they have everything locally that they need. I'm not saying that they want to be self-sufficient and like autarkist, right? Like, China does very much believe in international trade and in correspondence and helping, you know, collaborate on the idea of win-win cooperation, right? But if China needed to, what we're seeing is that it's an economic transition to be more self-sufficient. And the Western sanctions, these aggressive U.S. sanctions, have only accelerated that process. China now is producing, you know, its own planes, and it still uses some Western parts, but is working on making its own parts. China is now producing semiconductors, the most cutting edge semiconductors. So what we're really seeing is, again, part of this process of economic transformation, and internal tourism can be part of that.
I have another question. You know, I read the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and so forth, and they're always saying, oh, you know, you should diversify your portfolio away from China. But when I look at huge U.S. International companies that are traded on the NASDAQ and so forth, they are moving to China in force. So we see, okay, Yum Brands, which is, I think it's actually partially owned in Shanghai, Apple, Tesla, Starbucks, McDonald's is planning on opening 4,000 new branches over the next 5 years. And that's almost double the total amount of McDonald's that they have currently in China. So why are normal investors being told not to come to China, but all of the big brands are coming to China? Is there a reason for that?
It's political. What we see is, look, there's an economist, Hao Junchang. He's a South Korean development economist, one of my biggest influence, brilliant, brilliant guy. And he famously wrote in one of his books that the majority of economics is politics. That's why, you know, I'm interested in political economy, right? Because if you go back to the origin of economics as a discipline among, you know, the classical European political economists, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, they were political economists. And the removing politics from economics was part of this process in the late 19th century, going into the early 20th century, where there's this idea they call physics envy, right? This idea that you can create economics that is purely scientific and has nothing to do with politics and society, and you turn every human being into a utility-maximizing robot, and all products are reduced to widgets, and money doesn't exist, and banks don't exist, and countries don't exist, and every market is equal. I mean, it's ridiculous. They simplify everything to the point that it's, you're not describing reality, you can't understand what's reality, in order to try to make these mathematical models work. In reality, when we look at a political economy framework, we can see very clearly that investors are not simply motivated by economics as like this abstract science that is like physics. It's not. In reality, a lot of investors are driven by politics. And if they're told by the United States, if they're told by the Western media, don't invest in China, they will withdraw. Now, the big corporations that are investing, they want access to the Chinese market. These are a little different, right? Because they're not investing in Chinese companies, right? They want access to the 1.3 billion people, including, as you said, the over 400 million people in the middle income bracket. They can be customers for these big companies. So what we're seeing is that there's an attempt, it's part of the economic war that the US is waging on China. They're telling investors, and all the media outlets are telling investors, China is risky. Do not invest in Chinese companies. And that's why we've seen this significant fall in the market cap of many companies in the Shanghai Exchange and the Hong Kong Exchange. And again, that's not the Chinese economy. Unlike the US, where everything is built around Wall Street, it's a financialized economy based on Wall Street. The idea in the US is what's good for Wall Street is what's good for the world. It's good for the country, but it's not true. In China, these things are separate. The stock market is not the economy. But what we're seeing is an attempt to tell investors it's not safe, withdraw your capital. And that's why the government has been trying to engage in policies to try to, you know, calm foreign investors' nerves. But again, because so much of the economy in China is driven, one, through state-owned enterprises, which make up probably around one third, maybe even higher, of GDP and about one third of gross investment in the country, capital investment. This is the base of the economy. And then many of the other important companies are actually not listed on these exchanges. So you have to understand that the Chinese model is completely different. What's funny is I actually saw there was an analyst that was on NBC News and they were talking, it was a section about the Chinese stock market. And he said exactly what I'm saying. This is a mainstream, you know, analyst on NBC in the West. And he's like, look, you have to understand the Chinese model is different. It is a socialist model. And he's like, people thought that China was just throwing that word around. They're not throwing it around. It is a socialist model. And they have elements of private ownership and markets, but it serves the purpose of the overall economy of Chinese working people. And at the end of the day, you can't simply see what's best for the US economy and act as if that's the best for what's going on in China. So for instance, another factor that people are talking about is foreign direct investment. They say, oh my God, FDI has dried up in China. In reality, FDI only makes up around 1% of Chinese GDP. This is not the 1990s, in which FDI was making up 5, 6, 7% of GDP. It's not to say it's not important, but China has developed its own domestic capacities to such a degree that it's not as reliant on foreign capital anymore. And in fact, China is often doing much more investment abroad. Mm-hmm, so again, we're living in a very different era. The Chinese economy is not the U.S. economy.
I was looking at some of those numbers. FDI this year, 2023 was roughly equal to 2022. But people are talking about the total amount of FDI. Currently, a lot of Chinese investors are investing in the underdeveloped world, in Europe, United States, elsewhere. So there's a net outflow of FDI. So that's just because China's gotten rich enough where they can actually start to invest in other countries. So I think that, you know, the concept of net FDI outflow is kind of strange when we have the same amount of total FDI inflow as just a regular number. I wanted to switch to America, though. We're both Americans, and both of us are concerned about, you know, our American brothers and sisters. I was told not to overuse that term by a friend of ours. But, you know, the richest 1% in America now has as much wealth as 60%. In the 1980s, from the 1980s to now, wages have increased. And so a lot of politicians point to that in our home country. And they say, hey, look, you know, you're making more money than you used to. But CPI has increased faster than that. So could you kind of explain to us, are American consumers as wealthy as they once were? I mean, in fact, are they actually getting wealthier? Or why do people feel when they go to the grocery store that they can't afford as much as they used to?
Well, objectively speaking, it's a fact. No, they are not wealthier, because we have to distinguish income from wealth. And this is a sleight of hand that many neoliberal economists often engage in, and many Western politicians. They only talk about income, not wealth. Many Americans, many North Americans, have net negative wealth because they think they own a house, but the bank owns the house. They owe often more than the house is worth to the bank when you factor in interest rates on the mortgage, right? Oftentimes, you're going to spend 3 times, 4 times as much as the house would have been bought for with the interest rates in your mortgage, especially because banks engage in a very exploitative practice. And if you look at, my brother showed me this actually, because he bought an apartment in the US, and he showed me it's a 30-year mortgage, and they stack all of the interest at the beginning. So for the first few years, you're basically only paying interest. And then over time, the percentage of the initial capital, the initial cost of the loan, you're going to slowly pay that off later toward the end. So if you look at a mortgage, it's a 30-year mortgage. Oftentimes, the first 10 years, you're paying like 90% interest. And then the last 10 years, you're paying maybe like 80% of the capital and like 20% interest. And this is just a symbol for how unbalanced and uneven the economy is in the US, where 10% of the population owns nearly 90% of stocks. 1% of the population owns the majority of stocks. And then if you look at other forms of assets, like for instance, real estate. Real estate housing has become a speculative asset in the US. And you constantly hear people, I've heard this from friends and family, get a house now, buy a house because it's a nest egg, right? For a retirement. Like, you need a house because it's the only wealth that you have. That's why people are willing to take out these 30-year mortgages on very uneven terms, very unequal terms, because they know it's the only wealth that they have. Furthermore, we've also seen that the cost of living has skyrocketed. So yes, consumer goods are still relatively cheap, largely because they're produced abroad, right? In countries with much lower wages. But all of the other costs of living are extremely high. Education is becoming privatized, and so private education is extremely expensive. Health insurance is a joke. I mean, it's outrageous. It's not even a joke. That makes it sound too kind. It's a tragedy. It's so horrific to see the tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars that people are forced to pay. I mean, I had an experience with this when I was in college in the US, and I was on a bike and I was hit by a car, and I woke up in the emergency room. I blacked out and I got hit. I was only in the hospital overnight for like 13 hours. And then I got like 5 or 6 bills, because they're all from different private companies. And it was like 20 something thousand dollars, which I was a college student. I didn't have that money. I didn't pay it, like many people in the US. I mean, so we have trillions of dollars of debt in the form of medical debt and student loans, nearly $2 trillion of student loans. So the US economy is what is increasingly referred to as the everything bubble. Everything is based on this big bubble of pumping up asset prices because it makes the rich richer. If you look at the obscene wealth of these big capitalist oligarchs, these billionaires like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, the vast majority of their wealth is in the form of these assets like, for instance, in securities, in stocks, in companies, especially their big tech companies, which are part of this huge bubble I mentioned. In the stock market now, in the Western press, they talk about what they call the Mag 7, the Magnificent 7, which was originally, you know, like Meta, Amazon, Google. It's where like magnificent comes from. It's Meta, Alphabet, Amazon, Nvidia, Tesla, and I'm skipping two others. But the point is that you have these big tech monopolies and they ridiculous growth in this huge bubble. And so much of the wealth of the rich is tied up in these assets, along with housing. So average people, how can you compete with that? You can't. Maybe it looks like you have, in terms of your disposable income, like you have a higher standard of living than other countries. But the whole point in the US, the fundamental problem is that this is a country, it's the center of world capitalism, and the rich capitalists all around the world hold their wealth in the form of US assets. And the US government has engaged in policy for decades now, going back to the neoliberal era, of inflating the price of these assets, the value of these assets, in order to inflate the wealth of capitalists all around the world. And that means that to actually live in the country as a working person, it's become prohibitively expensive. And it also means that it's extremely expensive to produce manufacturing locally. So it has further facilitated deindustrialization. So it's in this, it's an unsustainable system. And eventually that bubble is going to pop. And what when it pops, we're going to see something like 2008, maybe even worse than 2008. And I think a lot of people are going to demand in the US a fundamental change to the system. What worries me is that we see politics lurching further and further to the right in general in the West, in the US, in Europe. And any even mildly left-wing possibility of change, people like Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, who are not even very radical, they're seen as, you know, these crazy radicals. So the situation is very unstable. And the inequality that we see amid rising poverty, rising homelessness, rising hunger because of food prices skyrocketing, it's going to lead to a lot of political instability. So this is why earlier I used the term projection, psychological projection. The Western economies are really in a moment of crisis. And it seems to me like a lot of the media outlets are projecting their own insecurities onto China.
You know, I mean, I see that and I think you're right. I also think that part of it is they don't want Americans to know the standard of living that Chinese people have achieved, and especially in urban areas, because Americans probably would be jealous. 90% home ownership. You say that to Americans, I mean, with no mortgage, practically no medical expenses, it's a completely different world. I wanted to talk about the rise of the West a little bit because, you know, Western European countries, France, Spain, UK, United States to a large extent, I mean, not the large, enormously benefited from exploiting other people. I mean, the United States, like you mentioned earlier, was founded on basically the erasure of an entire people. The amount of millions of people that were erased, murdered to make way for the United States, plus all of the slavery, plus all of the invasions. I mean, the UK went around the world, invaded most places, you know, India, the places all over China, countries all around the world. The G7 largely grew out of the wealth of colonialism, imperialism, and exploitation. Has that been the case for China? Has China's rise also been through global imperialism? How has China's rise been different from that of Western European powers in the United States?
China's rise has been the opposite of the economic rise of the West. The economic development of the West was fundamentally based on what is known as primitive accumulation, extracting the wealth and resources and capital of colonized people and enslaved people through, again, massive colonization of every corner of the world and enslavement of millions of Africans, genocide and ethnic cleansing of native peoples, taking their natural resources and land. And China has not done any of that, which is why these outrageous U.S. accusations against China, it's just they're so hypocritical. And if you look at China's economic development, it's also the only formally colonized, or China would say partially colonized in the century of humiliation, the only formally colonized country that has been able to move up the value chain of technological and industrial production and become a relatively advanced economy without having to resort to imperialism and foreign exploitation in the way that the West has. The only other maybe exception people would say is maybe South Korea, but South Korea did so through massive support in the form of aid and loans and technology transfer by the United States. And if, and still today, South Korea is militarily occupied by the U.S. with 28,000 U.S. troops who have been there since the early 1950s. So it really doesn't have sovereignty. So it's really been an extension of the U.S. in that way. But of course, South Korea is also relatively very small compared to China, which is 1.3 billion people. So, I mean, I always say this, and I'm not being hyperbolic. It's not an exaggeration. I really do think the economic rise of China is one of the most important developments, economic and political developments, social developments in modern history. And it's, again, the fact that China has done so peacefully is amazing because it, first of all, it shows that there is a possible way for a country to develop economically through other means, not through imperialism. If it has, again, a socialist system that is predicated on mutually beneficial cooperation and not this idea that we have to win and you have to lose, this zero-sum game where we extract your resources and we exploit you and you get nothing for it, which is what the British did to South Asia, to India. It's what the French did to Algeria. It's what the US did to the Native Americans. And that's why, if you look at the Global South, the vast majority of countries, they're not looking to the US as a model economically. They can't just replicate what the US did. Many countries are studying what China is doing. And I've met a lot of these people here in Beijing, people from parts of Africa and other parts of Asia and Latin America, who are studying the Chinese model, studying development here, and trying to see how they can implement some of those ideas in their own country.
You mentioned the everything bubble. Debt in the United States, financing of debt, paying the interest on U.S. debt, federal debt, has reached roughly the same income that we get from taxes. So I mentioned this online, and a lot of people were like, yeah, this is a big problem. They're very worried about it. But a couple of people mentioned, oh, well, it doesn't matter. The United States, because of dollar dominance, can just keep doing this, you know, for an infinite period of time. There are also people talking about de-dollarization. Is there the possibility that de-dollarization reaches an inflection point, which makes it difficult for the United States to maintain its current account deficit spending?
Yeah, well, this is the funny historical irony, right? At the moment where we see global de-dollarization at the highest level in decades is also the moment where kind of MMT has become mainstream. And I'm not against modern monetary theory. There are a lot of very good economists who have talked about MMT. And the thing about MMT is it's misunderstood because MMT is simply a factual description of how money works in a fiat system since the 1970s when the dollar was delinked from gold. Almost every currency in the world, well, at least the majority of them, have been freely floating and have not been backed by gold. Some of them are pegged to the dollar or another currency. But the point is that it's a description of how money works. However, the problem with mainstream MMT thinkers is that they ignore the Global South and they only think about the US because most of these people, the MMT theorists, are in the US. So they only think about money in the context of the US dollar. But this is the point that I've always said and I've been critical of MMT about, is that if you're a poor country in the Global South that chronically has a current account deficit and you have to import oil and gas, maybe foodstuffs, you're not food sovereign, you import energy, you import technology and capital goods, you cannot simply use MMT and the government cannot simply print the money to provide the services that people need and the jobs that people need because you would have significant inflation. This is exactly what has happened in countries like Argentina, which are suffering from hyperinflation because they don't have enough of the foreign currency that they need to service their dollar-denominated debt. Whereas in the US, people say, oh, well, the US can do that because there's global demand for the dollar. But as de-dollarization increases, well, we see it's a chicken and the egg thing. It's dialectical, right? As de-dollarization increases, it's going to be harder and harder for the US to simply print more and more dollars by selling treasury bonds. Because how does this work? Well, the way it works is that the U.S. deficit spends, so the Treasury prints bonds, which are, you know, U.S. government debt that you can invest in, and they have an interest rate, right? And their interest rate is set based on auctions. But if there is a decreasing number of investors because the Central Bank of China and Russia and other big institutional investors are no longer buying U.S. treasuries. There's less demand, which means that interest rates are going to go higher. So it becomes more expensive for the U.S. to lend, to borrow, excuse me. It becomes more expensive for the treasury to borrow from investors, which is what people who buy bonds are, right? So that means that interest rates are going to be higher, which means that as the U.S. debt increases, the interest rates go higher and you have this self, you know, this positive feedback loop. Furthermore, as the U.S. has raised interest rates, that also has raised the interest rates on bonds, because investors are not going to buy these bonds if the interest rates are lower than the interest rates set by the Fed. They can invest in something else. Furthermore, the reason that the Fed has been raising these interest rates like this is because of inflation in the U.S. And if they try to drop and try to drop interest rates by the Fed in order to drop the interest rates on bonds, it's probably going to bring back inflation. So you have this crisis that the U.S. is in, and they're running 6% of GDP deficits. And meanwhile, we talk about de-dollarization. I mean, the most important element of de-dollarization is the decrease in demand for treasuries by the biggest institutional investors in the world, which are, excluding the, you know, the asset managers on Wall Street like BlackRock, excluding them, central banks, the People's Bank of China, which had previously bought trillions of dollars of U.S. bonds. Well, now, for a decade now, they've been decreasing. They've been a net seller of U.S. treasuries. And overall around the world, we see many central banks diversifying. They're not completely dropping the dollar, obviously, but they're using other assets. They're also using gold in the reserves. So this is the ultimate irony, is that at this moment when MMT kind of became mainstream and you know, Stephanie Kelton is being like an advisor for the Biden administration, it's also at the moment when it's the end of U.S. dollar hegemony. So the reality is, I think that we're going to have to see some kind of global rebalancing, because this system is completely unsustainable. It was always predicated on the dominance of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. exporting its inflation around the world. And it was also always predicated on other economies subordinating themselves to the United States. And it gave the U.S. the ability to try to basically destabilize any foreign government it didn't like. Cuba has suffered from this for over 60 years, the DPRK for decades as well. And now we see that just in the past few years, the U.S. has illegally seized the central bank reserves of Iran, Venezuela, Afghanistan, and now Russia. And we now see reports that the U.S. and the EU are planning on using $300 billion worth of assets held by the Russian central bank. Largely, actually about two-thirds of it is in the EU system. But the point is that the West is going to steal this and then use it to fund Ukraine. And that's going to be a massive shot in the arm of the global de-dollarization movement, because even historical Western allies, countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, are now diversifying and they're holding other reserves. They're trading in other currencies other than the dollar. And they just joined BRICS. Mm-hmm. So we're really in this kind of historical watershed moment. And as I said, you know, China's been going through an economic transition. President Xi announced in 2017 the announcement of a new era of socialism with Chinese characteristics. So a lot of analysts are saying that we can understand this in, since the revolution in 1949, kind of three eras in China: the Mao era ending in 1978 with the reform and opening up initiated by Deng Xiaoping, and the new era initiated by President Xi in 2017. So as China is going through this economic transition, it's part of a larger global, you know, geopolitical transition with de-dollarization, the creation of new institutions, the expansion of these institutions like the BRICS, the New Development Bank, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the relative decline of the West to such a degree that I did a report in which I looked at an article that was written by the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, and he admitted in a post that he published on the EU's website, the diplomatic services website, he said, the era of Western dominance has ended. And he said that the EU is worried because we are alienating the global South. He said the global South accuses us of double standards. We have to try to win back the global South, and we cannot simply divide the world between the West versus the rest. However, as I mentioned in my report on that, I'm very skeptical of the capability of Europe to do that, because they can recognize that this is a problem, but all of their actions in terms of the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza, the Western sanctions, all these policies are only further facilitating this division of the world between the West versus the rest.
Wow. It's always amazing to have you on as a guest. I have one last question. If you can keep it short, we do want a lot of more people from the United States to come to China, to see China for itself, for themselves, so that they can have a better idea of the reality of what China's like beyond, you know, what they're hearing and whatever media that they're you know, including this, wherever they're getting their media, it'd be far better if they just came here and saw China for themselves. So I want to see more university students, workers, and so forth come from the United States to work and study in China. You are currently studying at a university in China. Could you tell us about how does it compare to studying back home, and what has it been like settling in?
Yeah, well, it depends on what program people are going to do, right? It's very heavily dependent on the program. But Chinese universities are very, very good. I'm impressed by the quality of the professors and the quality of the students. And especially the Chinese students that I've met are brilliant. And some of, you know, the foreign students, it depends, especially it's complicated politically, right? Because, you know, because I'm doing international political economy, you will have very heated discussions often, especially with some of the Western students who are surprisingly, I mean, it's good that their views are being challenged, but I think they're surprisingly still in this kind of bubble. But that's why it's good that they come to China, right? And have these experiences and hear other perspectives. And I've been consistently impressed by the quality of young students here in China who are very well educated. They understand what's going on in the world. Also, the new generation have grown up in a time where they're very proud of China's economic development. They're no longer trying to just impress the West, whereas there was a generation of people, you know, who went and studied in the West in the 80s and 90s and were kind of insecure. Today, a lot of people are very proud, but I'm not saying that in an arrogant way. They're actually very welcoming. I've always been very welcome. People are very polite, very humble. So it's been a great experience, a kind of learning experience. And also, there are a lot of other things to think about that I would highly recommend, especially for people in the US. First of all, the costs. Well, if you get a scholarship, obviously it's nothing. Well, you have maybe a little bit for the cost of living, which, as we talked about, is very low. I mean, it's high standard of living, but the cost is very low. And furthermore, even if you are going to end up paying tuition, if you don't get a scholarship, we're talking about a small fraction of what you would have to pay in the West for very high quality schools, high quality education. And we see that top universities in China are moving up the international lists and competing with Western universities. And also when it comes to academic journals, especially in a lot of the sciences, many Chinese universities are leading now, and they actually produce more academic research than the US and European universities. So I think it's a great opportunity for people thinking about a PhD or master's or even undergrad, if you're still relatively young and watching this. It would be a great opportunity. And also, just again, even if you're just going to come for a year or two, do a master's or something, I would highly recommend it, because it can be a life-changing experience. You can see firsthand what China is like. You can meet people, understand their perspectives, and you can fact-check the ridiculous Western media propaganda and see that it's the exact opposite of what you're told by the media. I mean, it can be a very kind of revolutionary experience, seeing something in the media and then with seeing your own eyes and being like, actually, this is not true at all. It's completely absurd. So I think that I think it's a very smart move by the Chinese leadership to announce this policy of encouraging more person-to-person exchange. And the government has announced that in the next 5 years, they're trying to, they have scholarships and spaces for 50,000 US students, 10,000 a year. I think that's a very smart idea to encourage more personal interchange between these countries, because, you know, the Western politicians, unfortunately, are so invested in this anti-China propaganda, and it's become this kind of bipartisan obsession. And basically, all of politics is about scapegoating China for all of the domestic problems in the US. Politicians in the West are incapable of addressing, solving these problems like homelessness and drug addiction and poverty and inequality. So instead, they try to scapegoat China. So one of the ways of trying to encourage better relations is having a generation of young people coming and seeing for themselves and learning that not every society is suffering from extreme inequality and poverty and homelessness. In China, despite the fact that China is still developing, these problems do not exist. So they can be solved if you actually have a government that is dedicated to solving these social problems and not simply enriching the rich, pumping up their asset prices, making life unaffordable for the 99% in order to make the 1% even richer.
Wow. It's always great having you on the show. I feel inspired every time I hear you speak. Thank you so much for your time, Ben Norton. We can find more of you at geopoliticaleconomy.com. Thank you again.
Thanks, Jason. Keep up the great work. It's always a pleasure. Oh, yeah.